notified that thy kind hath infiltrated the galaxy too far already. Thou art directed to return to thine own solar system immediately.
That's quite a directive. Would you mind identifying what you are?
We call ourselves the Cube. Well, thou mayst call me that. It's all much the same thing.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me on the newly glued-together bridge...
This is Tyler Orton, still struggling to whistle Pop Goes the Weasel.
You've never struggled with that before.
You know, it's my programming, man. It's just getting all jittery.
Okay, and this week we are here to rank the series premieres.
Yeah, I mean, look, every one of them is very distinct when it comes to Star Trek, and I think this is also going to give us the opportunity to ponder towards the end what we expect and what we think we need from a Star Trek Picard series premiere, which I think is going to be an incredibly different endeavor than anything we've seen before in Star Trek, because our main character is somebody that we're so familiar with. Mm-hmm. So I do wonder how premise heavy it's going to be, or how much it's going to be reframing this character of Picard that we're already very, very intimate with.
Yeah, for sure. And it's interesting going through these lists of premieres, and they really do change in form, even in the way these episodes, not just in terms of the storytelling, but in the way they are delivered to an audience.
Yes.
Like, and it's going to be interesting to delve into each of them individually and look at the situations that kind of made them what they were.
Well, let's kick it off with something I think is a very interesting genesis here, which is the Man Trap.
Really interesting.
Like,
yeah.
Cam,
is it even a premiere? Well, I mean, it is a premiere.
The
yes.
answer is this is a series premiere of Star Trek. So, and it's kind of curious because for those that may not recall, this is what, the 8th episode that was filmed?
Yeah, I believe so. Yeah.
And so we had, what was it? The Cage that was the original series premiere. Then we have Where No Man Has Gone Before was the first one with Kirk.
Yeah.
And then I think the Carbonite Maneuver was meant to be the first one to actually, you know, appear on TV sets.
Correct. Yeah. And then the effects weren't done in time. So they went with the Man Trap. And it's like the Man Trap, and we're going to get to the rankings at the end of the show.
Yeah.
But the Man Trap has such an unfair advantage over every other one of these pilots in the sense the lead actors all had time to gel together as a unit. So when you see them show up in the Man Trap, they actually can play off each other really well versus some of the other ones we're going to talk about where you can feel, you know, the characters are maybe a little off model or the actors haven't quite gelled together. The Man Trap doesn't have those problems.
It's very curious, though, because you're watching this and you kind of, if you're a viewer the first time, this is your first experience watching Star Trek, you're like, you know what? If anything, I love the high concept and I like the characters that they really work together quite well. Here is the fatal flaw of the Man Trap, though. Cam, this is a Dr. McCoy episode.
Yeah.
This is not really the series moving forward, though. I mean, we get the triumvirate develop, you know, as the season goes on more and more, but
I was actually surprised they were together as much as they were in this episode.
Yeah, because look, I think if you are launching a series premiere, it needs to really focus on your main character.
Right.
And your main character, no matter what you want to argue, it really is James T. Kirk here. And then to the next...
Shatner agrees with you.
Well, obviously he would in that case. But and then, of course, the next one on the call sheet is going to be Leonard Nimoy. And surprisingly, Spock had maybe a little less to do than I had actually originally remembered upon my rewatch here. And so all that set aside, I mean... If you're an audience member, like way back in 1966, Cam, almost exactly like 43 years ago, is this going to be gripping to you? Just if anything, for the high concept, you know, showcase that you're getting here.
I think it might be.
Yeah.
Because to me, when I'm watching this episode, I went into it with the memory that it was kind of like, here's a random episode to start the series. Whereas like, they actually do a pretty good job giving each of the characters little bits of introduction. Yeah. So you actually have an understanding as to who each of them are. You understand their relationships. Characters who sometimes would be ignored in an episode, like Sulu or Uhura, are actually given moments to actually have personality. Janice Rand as well. And it has a very simple concept to the episode, basically a Dracula-type story, you know, this salt vampire. that I think is very easy to understand for an audience. You get to see a strange new world. You even have a phaser fight, which wasn't something that happened that often on the original series. And it kind of wraps up in this fairly actually exciting hour of television that I go, if I'm a viewer in 1966, like 1960s television doesn't generally have this sort of energy, and especially like the vibrant colors that are going on here. They were on the Batman show as well, but they must have seen this and thought it did stand out as something very different and like energetic.
Yeah, if you're an executive at the time, I think you probably made the right call. All things being equal, I'm sure they would have liked to have the Carbonite Maneuver ready to go.
Sure. I think that one is a better representative of the concept of Star Trek.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't know that this one sells the higher ideals of what Gene Roddenberry was trying to sell.
But under the constraints that they were under.
Yes.
This one actually kind of works as a series premiere. It's definitely not ever going to make any of our top 20 lists of Star Trek TOS episodes.
Right.
But I think this is a perfectly fine, acceptable series premiere to give you a taste of what this is going to be week to week. I just come back to the fatal flaw of this, which is that it is a McCoy episode. It's not a Kirk episode. And so I wonder if people, their expectations were just a little bit, no pun intended, warped going into maybe subsequent episodes.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I guess you can say it does really give you a good understanding as to who Kirk is. Like, I feel like his interactions with McCoy and Spock and all, you really do get an understanding of that character. But yes, I do agree. You want to essentially start with a Kirk story.
Yeah.
That makes the most sense.
So maybe briefly touch on this, because I understand that you rewatched this one, Cam. But tell me just your thoughts on maybe the animated series premiere.
Yeah, I actually think it's really good. Going into it, again, you're like, well, I don't know that they have that much ambition when they're putting the series together. Because obviously they didn't have the money to work with. Any other Star Trek show has had to work with, right? They know they have the cast and then very limited money for animation. And I was actually really surprised how, exciting a story Beyond the Farthest Star is. It was actually written by Samuel Peeples, who wrote what could have been the pilot for the original series, Where No Man Has Gone Before. And he also created the show Lancer, which is had a bit of a resurgence thanks to Once Upon a Time in Hollywood.
That's true, yeah.
But there is this very classic Star Trek type story of, you know, this force on the ship and how are they going to get it off the ship. You get to see some really crazy alien environments where they go to this like insectoid ship, and it's really showcasing what the animation can do that the original series never could. You get character dynamics. You've got Spock and McCoy sniping back and forth. And if you thought maybe, you know, as you're watching this, well, this is definitely like Star Trek for kids, where you have kind of the action adventure storyline. It ends on this insanely melancholy note where they're like, they manage to get this alien entity off the ship by, making it think they're going to crash into a star. It leaves the ship, and then they're, taken off like, well, that's done. And it cuts back to like this entity being like, don't leave me.
Yeah.
I'm so lonely.
So what you're getting
at,
though.
It's crazy. Like, it just has this.
If you're a viewer at that time, you're like, okay, I get what they're trying to do here. I'm happy to tune in week to week after this. Like, they've kind of effectively showcased what this series is going to be week to week.
But it also, again, like, gets to the heart of what Star Trek is. It's not just an action adventure with aliens. There is like a human emotion to it or ideas to it. And like, I think it was pretty clear off this pilot, what it was selling is like, we have all the imagination of animation, but there is still that adult core to it. It's not dumbing it down for everyone.
If we can have a little bit of fun here, we never got to see Star Trek Phase 2, but if we want to pretend that the motion picture was in fact the pilot for Star Trek Phase 2, take away your appreciation for this particular film. How does it work for you? It's a hypothetical, I know it's not real, but a hypothetical series premiere for the next iteration of Star Trek, Cam.
I think people would think they're in for a very slow-paced TV show.
Is that going to get people to tune in week to week after this?
Judging from a lot of the reactions to the motion picture, probably not.
Yeah.
No, so. I don't think so. It totally is grounded in that 1970s approach to science fiction, but I'm also not sure that that's what grabbed people on TV, you know, when they're sitting at home and just want to watch something for an hour. I don't know that's what they really wanted.
I'm just wondering, the thing that it has going for it, though, is getting the band back together.
Yep.
And
which the animated does as well.
Yeah. It would have been taken away a little bit, though, because we know that it would not have been featuring Leonard Nimoy. It would have had Zahn as the Vulcan first officer here. Mm-hmm. And so, I don't know, it would have been a curiosity had this thing ever been produced and we got to see it realized on screen. The next closest thing we can do is look at the more highly budgeted motion picture, which is kind of interesting.
And does it do a good job establishing Decker and Ilya as your series co-leads or whatever they would have been?
I guess it does, because honestly, this is not a TOS-centric, crew-centric film. It's really the Decker and Ilya story. It just kind of, it's a weird sort of throwback to where, you know, your episodes would focus on the guest stars of the week, you know, but right. I guess they were meant to be regulars. So it's an interesting little kind of novelty that we can reflect on. Let's go to kind of the big meaty stuff here. I'm talking Encounter at Farpoint. This is what people have been waiting for a long time.
No, not meaty. Apples, Tyler.
Apples. I told you not to do that. Yeah. Oh, so this is okay. I'll give it credit here. It kicks off like very fast paced.
It does. Yes.
I was impressed. I kind of forgotten that, but like the Q stuff right from the get go.
Yeah.
I'm props to that. You kind of establish the stakes. You're in with it. You've got a very charismatic antagonist. You are starting to get the vibe of the crew. I wonder how people were reacting in real time to the Patrick Stewart of it all, because we can watch an episode like this with mm-hmm. like 30 plus years of hindsight, and I'm loving Patrick Stewart in this. Like, he's kind of got a grasp on this character, as you say at the beginning, off model, you know, to some degree.
Yeah.
But I just wonder, were people like, what, is he supposed to be the captain week to week? Like, this guy's a dud.
Yeah, and also, boy, that Tasha Yar is a really dynamic character. Can't wait to see what she does.
Well, no kidding. She had so much great stuff to
do. Yeah, like, she is a major presence in at least the first half of that episode.
Yeah, but then you've got other characters who I don't think were well-served at all. I feel bad for Marina Sirtis with what they were giving her to do as Deanna Troi. She's, like, one of the most beloved characters, but not based on episode one, where it's just, like, screaming her emotions, you know, pain.
So lonely.
It's like, you know, like
there's a lot of characters like mournfully announcing their emotions in these Star Trek premieres, apparently.
I mean, I do that like whenever I meet somebody for the first time. I don't want to pick apart like little moments. I think we should be thinking about these holistically, but there's an amazing moment where Troi and Riker first meet once again over by the turbo lifts, and Picard's standing right there, and they're speaking to each other telepathically.
Yeah.
And Picard's just staring at them. He has no idea that they're speaking telepathically. Right. This goes on about like five beats too long, where I'm just like,
isn't that why it's great? Because if you just cut it at that, you know, one beat, you're like, okay. But having it those five beats now makes it memorable, because you're like, this is one weird scene.
It really is. But here's where I will get into more of the holistic critique of this. And I think this is because of studio interference, though. As we know, this was not originally going to be like a Q feature at all.
Right.
It was going to, you know, focus on Farpoint Station.
And it was going to be called The Meeting at Farpoint, right?
Yeah. And then they said, well, Encounter sounds more mysterious. And
I agree with that.
I'm totally down with that, too. So the issue is, like, this episode is very choppy in that, like, there's clearly the Q stuff that kicks it off right at the beginning, which I thought was very effective, though. I think that's actually the way that you do want to start a series premiere.
Should then, they have scrapped the far point and done the Q stuff?
I really think they should have. But the problem was the studio wanted a two-hour premiere.
Right.
So they originally had a script which was all focused on Farpoint Station.
Mm-hmm.
And then Q disappears for a long, long period of time.
Yeah.
And then he starts randomly coming back towards the end. And it's just, it feels like you're playing around with disparate pieces on a puzzle table. It's just like,
because it has this weird two different episodes mashed together kind of idea, the way the cast is introduced is really choppy and weird as well. Even though, like, Mantrap is, like, the eighth episode, it feels very, like, it establishes all your characters really well.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, the TNG one does not. Like, they feel kind of weird, like, wandering in, like, half an hour in, just like, oh, hey, yeah, I'm coming on the Enterprise now. And you're like, okay. But I thought Tasha Yar was my lead with, you know, with Captain Picard.
Well, it's so weird because you don't see Crusher or Riker for quite some time.
Yeah.
And, but there's also just weird moments with, like, Crusher back in the sick bay and Picard trying to get rid of her, like, off the ship.
Yeah.
I'm just like, okay, it's weird to think where their character journeys started with each other. And of course, him yelling at Wesley for being in the turbo lift. Like, there's a lot of, like, moments where I found this an incredibly entertaining thing to watch.
Yeah.
But mostly because I stood there just kind of bemused by it all, just knowing where the characters end up and knowing how off model a lot of this is from the kind of the week to week we'd be so used to from Next Gen.
I know this was an 11th hour rewrite for them to add all the Q stuff, but would it have been better in an alternate universe to have just started with the Q stuff and built up a 2-hour story around that, where like the trial for humanity in that first episode is related to something a little more attached to the actual Q character, as opposed to this random adventure on a planet that often looks like a bad soundstage?
I know, like I hindsight is 20/20. You know, in this case, like, how could they know a character like Q would endure the way that he did?
Sure.
You know, like, maybe they probably just didn't
know entrance, though, for a character they didn't maybe know would endure.
Yeah.
They give him, like, the most iconic entrance of any character in the entire cast. Quite possibly.
Who's the runner-up? I'm curious. Like, who gets maybe the next best intro?
Maybe Data walking in with Admiral McCoy?
Okay.
Maybe.
I'd give, you know, Picard doesn't get a bad one though. Like, he's in main engineering going down like the third story of that, that lift, you know, which is like, we never get to see that lift in action, especially like the third story of the engine room. It was kind of a cool shot that he got there.
Yeah.
I don't think, Riker or Crusher were well served by their intros.
And so, what was Geordi's again? I don't even remember.
He was on Farpoint too, and he was just hanging around the market with them.
That's right.
And
Worf's not a major character on the show yet, so
he had like more to do in this one. But there's some great moments where he starts pointing his phaser at the view screen as if he's going to shoot through the view screen, and then Picard has to tell him, "What are you going to do? Shoot through the view screen?" And he's like, "I'm sorry, sir. I will do better next time. I have learned from this."
Well, this is also the era where, like, Klingons in the movies weren't necessarily portrayed as the brightest.
No.
Like, Krug was not, like, a very brainy Klingon. And so I could totally see how that might have filtered into Worf in season one.
Just a lunkhead.
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. So, if I was a viewer back then.
Yeah.
I would be very wary of what I'm watching week to week. I could totally understand, and I'm not a fan of the Star Trek fans that whenever a new series is on, like, people declare, "That's not real Star Trek."
Yeah.
But I can understand why a lot of people are having this reaction, like, 32 years ago.
The most Star Trek-y moment, the Q character is very Star Trek-y, but also the moment that I always think of is the jellyfish creatures at the end, where... you know, the way we get there is really convoluted and weird, but those jellyfish having their little dance in the cosmos is very memorable to me. It's actually quite a motion picture type kind of thing.
I'd say it's iconic,
Yeah. It reminds me a bit of Gareth Edwards' Monsters. Did you ever see that?
I did, actually.
Yeah, that scene at the end where he has the monsters, and it's that similar kind of like... looking at them with wonder, not with like, aren't they scary or whatever? You know, like...
Did you like Monsters?
It's okay. Yeah. I like the monster stuff.
It's like, it got way better reviews than I expected it based on me watching it. And I was like, it's okay.
The human story is incredibly weak. Kind of like a counter at Farpoint.
Yes.
And like this pilot, all the Farpoint stuff I find really uninteresting. Like, most of it I've forgotten. Like, all the stuff with Q I remember really well.
Yeah.
And then the Farpoint stuff, I'm like, I remember apples and I remember a guy in a bad wig. Like, it's just not interesting. And if I were a new viewer who, let's just say, didn't even watch the original series, and I'm sitting down, oh, there's this new Star Trek show, you know, maybe I'll watch this. I don't think I would have come back after this.
No, and especially if you're coming back to next week, which is The Naked Now, and it's like...
No, that would have brought me back.
Okay, well, just the name alone.
Sure.
Yeah. But it's like, I think, like, everybody knows this, TNG got off to a rough start.
Oh, yeah.
So, this just kind of proved it there. But, like, it doesn't mean as if there were great elements part and parcel with it. Like, I really...
Well, it's not boring.
No.
Except for maybe at the end when you get to some of the exploding Farpoint stuff. Then it gets a little dull.
I agree.
At least it's weird enough and offbeat enough that you go, like, well... It's keeping my attention somewhat.
You know, even like the Trial for Humanity sequence that we saw with like Q freezing Tasha Yar, and like, it's actually like visually interesting stuff that Star Trek in the Berman era wasn't really known for visual stimulation, though.
Right.
And I like how these kinds of things really do stick in our mind, and it definitely becomes iconic, especially when you fast forward to All Good Things.
I think it's really interesting that at the 11th hour of Roddenberry, you know, cranking out this Q material, he comes up with the best theme for, like, the entire series, this Trial for Humanity.
Yeah.
That totally makes sense with the Picard character. This is going to be the guiding force of like the seven seasons, and it's all this stuff that was like out of desperation. But isn't that just like how writing works?
Yeah. Oh yeah. Yeah. It's weird how you can find inspiration in all these like strange places.
Yeah.
We should also mention that this series premiere also features one Colomini as the unnamed con officer in the saucer separation sequence. I can understand the logistics of having to do saucer separation every single week, but mm-hmm. I think they could have done that a little bit more often. It was a cool idea, and it kind of explained how you could have civilians on the ship all the time, even though you're in these battle situations. But
what do you think is the more iconic moment to come out of this episode? The Q entrance or the saucer separation?
That's a tough one. I defer to Q because I think people relate more to just other human beings as opposed to like objects. So I don't know. Where are you at?
I think I agree with that because, you know, when you look at the motion picture and you have that iconic scene of the introduction to the Enterprise, right? Is it iconic if you remove those moments of Kirk reacting to it, like getting that human emotion in the moment? The saucer separation is iconic and it's an amazing like technical achievement, but I don't know if it has the emotion that you get with like that Q entrance.
Yeah, and the reason I bring up Colomini is because he's featured, he gets his own spin-off series, going into Star Trek Deep Space Nine, once again featured in a series premiere. And the Emissary is an interesting one though.
Yeah,
I think this is a stronger one than we can get into the rankings later, but I think maybe they learned some lessons from the Encounter at Farpoint's premiere. And I'll say this, they kick this one off high octane with we get to see the Battle of Wolf 359 realized on screen. And it's not just an action sequence. You realize the emotional stakes for a character like Ben Sisko. You understand where he's coming from, his motivation with the death of Jennifer and him raising a son on his own for what would become the next 3 years.
Right. Yeah. And this was a hugely promoted event. Like, they really did sell this premiere as an event you had to be there for. I'm curious, actually, if the TNG one, that was a similar thing back in the day. I have no way of knowing. I was too young.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, this does feel very much a step up from what the TNG one was doing in the sense, like, I think they understood that the way they introduced all their characters in Encounter at Farpoint was really spotty and didn't really make a lot of sense. They found a really good way with this DS9 one, too. Establish the Sisko story right off the top, kind of like the Picard stuff as well, but also bring in all the characters very quickly after and have them all as established personalities that we actually understand.
But not too quickly in that, not like, everybody had their moment because you have, you know, you get to the station, you get, Kira gets to make a big entrance, Odo gets to make a big entrance, as does Quark, and then there's a bit of a gap, and then you've got Bashir and Jadzia showing up about halfway through the episode, and so you get to kind of, like, soak in with these characters just a little bit, kind of figure out what their quirks are. It's funny, and it's also, I give Sirach Lofton actually a lot of credit watching this now. You can actually really see how far he came across as like an actor, starting as a kid, let's be honest. And then we get to watch him grow into an adult. I give a lot of props to, say, Avery Brooks, obviously like mentoring this guy for a long, long time. Because he's also like, Avery Brooks is like a theater instructor. Like, he's a teacher. So it was fun for me. I know I'm getting into the granular once again, but it is fun to see these characters and these actors early on in their development.
Right. And he's also a father, right? And it was very important to him to have this sort of relationship with his son on screen. So you can tell he's very invested, and it really does come across. Like, I think maybe the most memorable image of this entire premiere, other than, I guess, some of the stuff with the wormhole aliens, just the idea of Sisko in that kind of white room or the white light, but is him looking out the window at DS9 with his arm around Jake.
I'm being so totally sincere as well. I think one of the most iconic shots in this is Jake and Ben fishing, like in the holodeck. Yeah. Like, I think people instantly recognize that moment there, and it really is setting up that father-son dynamic that is going to be very different for pretty much every Star Trek captain that we've seen up until this point. You know, like,
it's also the most important relationship for Sisko throughout the course of the series. There's other characters that come in, you know, Cassidy, Yates, and all that, but it's him and Jake that really are the big emotional core of the whole series.
But there are some faults in this one, though.
Really?
Yeah. You know. let's go to one Patrick Stewart. He, along with Colomini, gets to be in another series premiere. Rewatching this, I was like, he's actually in this like quite a bit more than I recall. It's not only just the new Locutus scenes. He also gets to meet with Ben. He's also appearing in the Prophet Visions as well. Then he's back at the end of the episode. I'm just like, you are earning that paycheck that you made them pay you. He's also got like this great goodbye moment with Colomini.
Yeah.
It's two emotionally aloof men that do not want to embrace. And it's both of them just nodding at each other. But the best moment is when it's literally Picard beaming O'Brien to the station. I was just like, they really nailed those characters in a hilarious way. Like, I was just like, bravo, guys. So, but the Patrick Stewart of all, Cam, tell me what you think the flaw might be here with regards to the introduction of your own main character going up against such an iconic, beloved character.
Yeah. I don't know that it's a great idea to have your lead actor, like, yelling at a beloved icon of the previous series. And the previous series is still on the air, of course, and it's hugely rated. Like, it's beloved. And I don't know if that's the best foot to start off on. Especially Picard. Like, there's different characters you could have Sisko yell at where people would be like, okay.
Wesley.
Sure. Or even if like Worf is a little out of line or something like that, Worf would obviously come back later on the show, but on DS9. But, you know, like a character who's maybe known to jockey between being more like right and wrong, right? In an argument. Whereas like Picard really is kind of the captain who knows best.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have Avery Brooks just like ripping into him, do you think that would even happen in a show nowadays? I kind of give them points because it does feel so outside of what like logical thinking would dictate.
I just wonder if it's the execution. And I go back and forth with regards to a lot of people's opinions on Avery Brooks. I think he has a very polarizing performance. And I admit, like, it took me probably two full seasons for me to really come around on his performance and embrace what he's doing. And I think Avery Brooks is very, very invested in the performance that he gives.
Yeah.
He's got to believe in what he's doing going up against Patrick Stewart. And I think he wants to establish him as a man who's still dealing with the loss of his wife. Like, I think Avery Brooks is reaching deep inside with his own anger and all that. And maybe it wasn't meant, maybe execution-wise, it wasn't meant to come off that way.
Yeah.
Cam, recall, you and I were in Vegas, and the director of this episode, David Carson, was there at a panel. Carson didn't have the kindest things to say about Avery Brooks. Like,
nope.
he had worked with him back in the 80s on Hawkeye and Spencer for Hire, I believe.
Right. Wasn't it just Hawk? I think it was. Was it Hawk?
Or is it a man called Hawk or something?
I think it was a man called Hawk.
Okay. So, I Jeremy Renner, you're all on my brain right now. Can't wait for your Disney Plus series.
No, Avery Brooks was the first Avenger.
Okay. I get it. I think David Carson, he said like something changed with Avery Brooks between the time that he initially worked with him in the 80s and the time that he hooked up with him once again in the 90s. And I just wonder how much of that played into his performance and how David Carson was trying to maybe guide the performance to a certain degree. But I don't think it's a bad idea on paper. I just wonder if there's like an execution thing. And if Avery Brooks came off as too harsh towards Patrick Stewart or you know, the characters came off too harsh, you know.
But also if you're Avery Brooks, you're going into this scenario, I don't know that you also want to be the actors getting blown off screen by the beloved favorite either. That doesn't make you look great as a series lead. It's almost like an unwinnable scenario to put those two in a room together in a disagreement.
It is. Cam, who do you think is the most off-model amongst all the characters that we're introduced to in Emissary? The main characters. They all have off-model moments.
They do. I mean, I feel like both Bashir and Jadzia feel... It's not like they're playing drastically different characters than we know and love, but it just feels a little looser, a little not as tightly written.
They haven't quite imbued the actors' own personalities so much into the characters just yet, you know?
Yes. They're also not playing very specific types like an Odo or a Quark.
Yeah. Bashir has some amazing moments, though, like in just like what a green little officer he is with like him going, yes, sir, like and chasing after like Kira, you know, like just like these hilarious kinds of things where is it off model? Because this is a character who like started off as like one of the most annoying characters around, like, and he becomes like one of the most mature characters on the series. You know, like, I think it's indicative of his own arc, but it's just like there are these moments that just you're like, how is that the same character that we leave in What You Leave Behind? You know?
Yeah.
Quark has a moment too where it seems like very off model when like Sisko suggests, well, you could be a community leader, Quark. And then he just lets out this like laughter.
Yeah.
It's not like the Quark laughter that we'd be
right.
used to. It's, you know, there's just moments that popped out to me that I was like, okay, you know, they're still finding their feet here.
But they feel fairly nailed down. Like the performances aren't quite matching up with what they would get with a little more practice and camaraderie as a cast. But it's not like TNG where some of them really just feel weird.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it does feel like they're at least on the right track. I was going to just go back to Avery Brooks for a second, though.
Yeah.
Do you think Avery Brooks in this pilot has a tougher job than Patrick Stewart did in his pilot? Where you look at what Avery Brooks had to communicate, all this stuff with these worm aliens, all this very bizarre science fiction, like very sci-fi heavy concepts. I think he really did have a tough job, considering how much of it is just him in front of a green screen with different actors walking in as wormhole alien voices. Like, that's really tough to sell to a new audience that isn't necessarily entirely made up of Star Trek fans.
I also just remember the interviews with Avery Brooks at the time,
mm-hmm.
and he seemed very indifferent about being part of the Star Trek universe.
Sure.
And, like, he was giving stuff like, hey, if I can be a role model to some kids out there, then that's great. But otherwise, it's just, like, green screens and, you know, Jeffrey's tubes. And
right.
he just kind of would shrug. So I don't know if he's reading the script and, like, understanding what his paw is and how it works in relation to the tears of the prophets in the Celestial Temple and, like, how it all relates to baseball as well. And he's just like, I'll just go where my gut takes me here.
Like, this is a very, like, convoluted script to ask for, an audience to follow for a pilot, and so grounded in Bajoran religion stuff that would be a factor going forward, but isn't necessarily representative of what the series is going to be.
Yeah. I still don't understand how you and I have not done Avery Brooks on the beach cosplay at any of these conventions where we're just carrying around trays of lemonade and, like, pretending the sand underneath our feet is really hot.
What are you talking about? We do that at the pool every day in Vegas. Look for us.
Maybe the other thing that I want to point out, though, is praise be to the prophets for landing Mark Alimo as Gul Dukat, who mm-hmm. is not actually supposed to play Gul Dukat for this episode. They had another actor. It wasn't working out. I guess they went to the first Cardassian that they had ever cast, and it worked for us, though.
Right.
Like, we got very lucky with him being the antagonist. So there was just like this spark with him, like, right from the get-go, and it went on for another 7 seasons.
It's one of those great casting stories. You know, it's kind of like Hugh Jackman coming at the final hour to play Wolverine in the first X-Men movie, you know? You just get lucky sometimes with a great actor being locked into a role. One other question, actually. We talked about the saucer separation. A lot of that is to establish what this new Enterprise is. How do you think Emissary did establishing the DS9 station as an environment for a show?
You know, it's interesting because it changes throughout the course of the episode, in that, like, mm-hmm. we have O'Brien and Kira, everybody pitching in to do repairs. And I think it's kind of a fantastic sort of design.
Mm-hmm.
I like the interiors. I think they do establish that this is a real rust bucket right now.
Yeah.
And this is not, you know, the pristine Enterprise D that you're so used to. I think it's another genius decision on the part of the writers to do this. How do you think they established the station as a character in and of itself, Cam?
Well, they do a really good job establishing it as a work in progress. You know, it's still very beaten up from the previous occupants, the Cardassians. And a lot of the characters are coming from very rough backgrounds as well. So it is kind of this symbolic of they're all in various states of needing repair. And we're going to kind of trace it through the show as the station gets, you know, in better and better shape. And so the characters, too.
Yeah. This one, another little, not a nitpick, but I think, like, one of the faults, though, is, like, it does drag a little towards the end.
The back half, yeah. A lot of stuff with the wormhole aliens, yeah.
So, like, I was far more sucked into what was going on in the first half of this one, especially when you're meeting these characters for the first time and you get to reflect on their journeys, you know? So, look, if I'm a viewer at the time,
mm-hmm.
I'm actually much higher up on this than I would be Encounter at Farpoint. Like, I think people would be intrigued by what's going to happen week to week, especially knowing that we haven't really got to touch upon that wormhole just yet. You know, there's going to be some exciting things coming through, hopefully.
This one is interesting, too, in that, like, I enjoy it so much more after watching the series, and I wonder how much that plays into my final ranking.
Yeah, you know, I was debating, like, whether we can really, truly rank these within a vacuum.
Yeah.
I don't think that's possible, but we'll have fun with our rankings, though.
Sure.
Well, you know what? We didn't really talk about Armin Shimmerman that much, but guess what? He gets to be in the series premiere of Star Trek Voyager.
The baton passing character.
We've brought up the baton passers in every single one so far, so yep. He gets to do this in Star Trek Voyager. This is one where, like, they set up the high concept, you know, premise mm-hmm. of it right away, and I think I'm with it, like, going week to week. It just fascinates me how much, like, Tom Paris is, like, the secondary lead after Janeway. Like, I'm like, and you know what? If you carry through his journey throughout the remainder of the series, he's probably number four, right? It's probably Janeway, Seven, the Doctor, and I think it's Tom after that.
I would agree with that, yeah.
You know, and so it's just interesting to see, like, Robert Duncan McNeil got a lot of charisma. There's a reason why he played a different character on Next Generation, and they liked him so much that they're going to bring him back into Voyager. I've actually gone back and forth about my feelings on Caretaker, and I think there's a lot of stuff that it kind of drags. Like, if you're down on this Ocumpa planet, mm-hmm. how invested are you in the fate of these aliens and Janeway's ultimate decision, though? Like, they're establishing what her principles are, which I think is all very worthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I think when, you know, you have the interaction of Neelix and Kes in this story, and at the end of the episode, do you have a good understanding why those two characters are there?
I understand why Neelix is there. He's a guide.
Exactly.
I don't have a clue why Kes is allowed to be a passenger on this as well.
It's the sort of thing, like, the economy of characters probably should have required they turn that into one character.
Yeah.
And it probably would have worked out better for them in the long run in terms of, obviously, the complications that came in later down the road with their cast. But, yeah, because a lot of it is based on, as you said, the Ocumpans, and I don't really have any dislike of the Ocumpans. I like the character of Kes a lot, too. But it's an interesting place to start your premiere when we know that they don't really go anywhere in a series. Like,
well, because the series is essentially jumping from place to place to place. You're never staying in one place.
Yes.
So, huh.
And Caretaker is really interesting in that it's a 90-minute episode or 2-hour episode that I actually really, really enjoy a lot. But is it, like, representative of the series that's going to come? That's where it gets difficult. Quality versus,
let's representation. Maybe try to think of it in a vacuum, though.
Yeah.
Like, are you coming back for week number two? And I think you are, like, based on this premiere. I think it's a strong premiere. I think they do a good job on establishing all the characters.
Yes.
I couldn't believe how many great moments Tuvok has, where I'm just, like, I remember liking Tuvok for a long time. And I think a lot of it had to do with the premiere, just because, like, he seems to be, like, a really good companion for Janeway. He seems to be very deductive. You get a lot of the Spock vibes. Mm-hmm. And then that character just kind of goes into Exposition City every single episode subsequent to that. And that's kind of is disappointing. So that's why I want to view this in a vacuum and how this is representative of the series.
Yeah, well, it does, like, two really brilliant things for wanting you to continue down the road with this series, which is, it has the mashing up of the McKee and Starfleet, and you're like, oh, wow, like a ship of half and half. Like, how is this going to impact in terms of dramatic potential? Like, this could really be something. Now, we know it isn't, but off a premiere, it's genius. Second of all, they're lost. Oh, my God, we're in the Delta Quadrant. We've never been there. We're not going to see Klingons or Romulans the way we normally would on TNG. We are going to experience entirely new, strange new worlds. And they've got to get home. That's a really, really compelling hook for a series. So, like, as a leaving off point for, you know, going into the next Voyager episode, it's pretty genius. I think it's a really, really great conceptual pilot for a show.
Yeah. Oh, you know, you brought up the introduction of Deep Space Nine. We also get to see Deep Space Nine featured in this. It's always kind of cool to see how the directors of photography will light Deep Space Nine differently on TNG when it was featured in Birthright. Mm-hmm. And then you see it on Deep Space Nine, and then you see it lit differently on Voyager. That's just me geeking out, like, as a bit of a cinemaphile.
Wouldn't it have been cool to see it in one of the movies to see how they would have lit it then?
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
You know. What do you think about the introduction of Voyager docked at Deep Space Nine?
It's not bad.
I thought it was pretty cool.
It's pretty cool.
It looked majestic to me. I dug it a lot.
Voyager doesn't get like the grand debut that like the D did in Encounter at Farpoint. I feel like when you're getting that saucer separation, it's tough to compare.
But it wasn't its debut though.
No,
it's actually just like kind of a generic shot of the D going through space. You know,
opening credits though, Tyler.
Okay. You're much higher on the TNG opening credits than I am, by the way. So
okay.
I thought it was a great introduction to the ship itself. You got Paris in a shuttle putting the moves on the con officer, which is really uncomfortable. It's not stuff that's aged well at all.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder if they could have done a bit more of a bait and switch there. In like you're promoting, I don't know, through marketing or something, here's the new crew of the USS Voyager. You don't realize that half these people you meet are all going to die by the end of the hour.
Yeah.
You know, like, I wonder if there could have been something clever as opposed to kind of giving it all away that your chief medical officer, your first officer, your con officer, they're all going to die, you know. Because they do establish them as distinct characters.
So. Another Star Trek pilot would do that later down the road.
That's, not too far away.
That's true. What did you think of the introduction of Janeway?
You know,
she gets a pretty iconic entrance.
Hands on her hips,
yeah.
Looking down at Tom Paris at the penal colony.
Camera looking up at her.
Yes, I think that might be the strongest debut of any captain or any lead character in a Star Trek series. Just that shot, though. Like, she's got, this power position. She's an authority figure. I was kind of breath taken away when I'm seeing, Mulgrew in that position right there.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It almost gives that the pilot kind of a little bit of like a Dirty Dozen type vibe where it's like this crew being brought together. You know, you go get Tom Paris in the penal colony. You pull in like Chakotay from the McKee. It really does feel like it's going to be this like really volatile crew of really interesting personalities.
You've got B'Elanna and Harry going at it when they are in the clinic on the Akumpan world. So,
yeah.
And then
and some great sets too. Like it definitely feels like they're showing you some interesting environments.
I think our problem is right now, Cam, that you and I can't help but just think about a lot of the character dynamics just don't come to fruition, and I think that leaves us a little disappointed, even though we like the characters and we like a lot of the episodes and stuff. But we see this potential behind the caretaker pilot that is just a little bit unrealized, and I think that's our kind of disappointment.
That and the rickety bridge,
yet
or
another
ladder or whatever,
another rickety platform in Star Trek. So overall, I think this is a strong pilot. I don't know if this is quite as fast-paced intro as we got with Deep Space Nine and TNG when it's the Maquis Raider trying to evade the Cardassian ship in the Badlands. Mm-hmm. It's just not quite as strong, but I can't say this is a bad pilot for a series. Like,
right.
This is going to make you want to tune in week to week.
You know, Star Trek standards for pilots has been very shaky at this point in time, and I think it's a really, really solid one.
Yeah. So one of the reasons I wanted to go back and rewatch these premieres is because I was kind of worried, if I would just have recency bias.
Right.
Because we had just reviewed Broken Bow.
Yeah.
And I was quite high on it. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know what? I'm still going to give Broken Bow a lot of credit. I think this is so many lessons learned by the writers of the show during the Berman era.
Well, it's so good. It is the Berman era doing all these pilots we've talked about, you know, this group of four we're talking about, and that they are learning lessons and you're seeing the evolution of the premiere.
And to me, it really does spell out what the series is going to be week to week.
Yeah.
It's the first, you know, ship capable of this speed to go into more of these deep space sorts of missions. Humanity is still a little bit shaky right now. You've established your characters. I think this is, I said it before in a review a few weeks ago, this is a swashbuckling space adventure. You get to go from planet to planet. You meet strange aliens and new civilizations. Like, this is a really good pilot to me.
Yeah, no, it really is. And it has an interesting adventure element as well. I kind of was questioning in our review of that one whether all the stuff with the Suliban was a little much to bog down maybe a new viewer to the show.
Very mythology heavy.
Yeah, yeah. Whereas this is the launch of the first Enterprise. Do you need all that? But I think it does grab you in that it establishes all the characters really well. And it does feel like a crew that you can actually care about. I think the only one that I would have questions whether it was smart was the way they introduced T'Pol, and that it's does the audience member who's watching this pilot understand that they're going to care about this character versus it being an antagonistic character through a series.
It took me a long time to warm up to Paul. It took me, you know, very much like I said earlier about another character with regards to Ben Sisko. It took me about 2 seasons to fully warm up to that character.
Mm-hmm.
But, and the thing is, like, our other critique, though, is like you're introducing these characters and a lot of them are just kind of acting like jerks a lot of the time. You know, Archer turns out to be one of the nicest guys around, but he's just being kind of racist towards Vulcans. And Trip's being a bit of a jerk to Paul. And I still can't get over him like touching her ears with the decon gel and just like, dude, you don't need to be doing that. Like that's pretty weird.
Yeah, well, the whole decon gel scene by itself is...
Yeah, I mean, we can critique other things like, you know, the main title theme song, you know, which we'll never not get laughs out of that. But
what do you think of the framing device with, like, Archer and his father building models?
Not nearly as strong as the Battle of Wolf 359 to kick off your show. I'm sorry, guys, you know. I guess the big action sequence, though, is the Suliban chase scene, the Klingon, in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
Okay. Still doesn't quite compare with, you know, Battle of 359.
No, as an introduction.
Or Battle of Wolf at 359.
Right. As an introduction, that first, you know, minute or two of a premiere, it's not like a... I mean, I like the idea. I understand what they're going for, the idea of like a Klingon like running through this cornfield. It's very like Americana and then this alien element running in, being pursued by Suliban. I get it. It's a good idea.
Crop circles be happening, man.
Sure. But I don't know that the way it's directed, it's as iconic as it should be. Like, it feels a little pedestrian in the way it's shot.
I know what you're saying. Yeah. But, you know, there's so many shots in this that it's stuff I'd never seen in Star Trek before, you know.
Well, like the blurry room in the Suliban.
Or even, like, you know, using night vision for the first time in Star Trek. You know, like, there's some cool visual things that they're doing here, and I can only appreciate it. Like, I think it just, even from a lot of the high concept stuff, like, think about the helix that the Suliban were occupying. Like, that was a cool sci-fi idea that's, and they've got a lot more, well, their budget can go much further, like, by, you know, 2001 when this is going on air, just with regards to maybe CG and stuff. So they could have a little bit more wiggle room when it comes to those visuals. So, you know, I think they're on the right path here.
There's also a lot of energy to it. Like, you look at Encounter at Farpoint, and it feels very stately a lot of the time. It's a lot of characters standing around and having conversations, and not necessarily the most dynamic of conversations, whereas Broken Bow really does feel like it's on rails for a good section of it.
Now, the question I keep coming back to is, will viewers tune in week to week after this? At the time, I was still kind of huffing and puffing about the next spinoff. Like, I wanted Star Trek to be moving forward. So I wasn't fully on board with the whole idea of a prequel. So I don't, like, I can tell you at the time as a viewer, oh, yeah, I was tuning in week to week, but I think I was not sold on the prequel idea yet, so I was just a little bit wary of moving forward. I fully appreciate like how great a pilot it is now, but at the time, I didn't think it was the greatest pilot ever.
Did you get any sort of enjoyment out of seeing the earlier technology, like the grappler or them using shuttles instead of the transporter?
Definitely the grappler. I was just like, okay, you know, or what would they say? Like,
that is how science works.
Yes. Or like, we are ionizing our armor on the ship, you know, like that sort of stuff. I'm just like, okay, you know, I thought it was amusing.
Yeah.
But the other stuff that I, you know, at the time I was just like, well, that ship looks way more advanced than the Enterprise D at this point.
Right.
You know? So I, you know, like, there's stuff we can pick apart, but, forget about the whole vacuum thing. I'm telling you right now, in the year 2019, this is really how you should be doing a pilot for a Star Trek series, and in which you establish the characters, you establish a premise, you can get your head around that, and you just put them on an adventure and show them how they're going to be week to week.
Mm-hmm. Do you think the characters would have brought people back? Do you think they were established well enough? As you said, there was a lot of kind of snarking back and forth. But does it feel, do you think by the end, like these are characters that are going to be interesting to them?
No. Like that was my big struggle as well. Because it took me a little while to come around on Archer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I just thought he was a little too kind of vanilla for me at the time. You know, like it took a while for those nuances to emerge.
Well, he's not as specific a type as like Janeway or Picard or Sisko. Like, those really do feel like one of a kind characters. Whereas like Archer, I feel like I've seen a lot of Archers in other movies or, exactly. you know, properties.
Yeah, and you mentioned the DePaul stuff where
yeah.
she's kind of posed more as an antagonist more often. You know, it's I wasn't totally warming up to those characters. The ones that I think popped out to me at the time, though, it was Phlox.
Yeah, like, and for me, it was Hoshi, too.
Yeah, yeah. Because you liked her language skills in Brazil when she's going, oh,
you know what it was?
That honestly, sequence was so weird, Cam.
It is weird.
Yeah.
But what really grabbed me with her was, like, she was someone who was very nervous about going to space, and I'd never seen that before. I'm like, oh, that's an interesting thing for a Star Trek character. That's cool.
Yeah.
And it doesn't really pay off, but as a pilot, it did.
So, Cam, this next situation is a very interesting one.
Yeah, what's exactly the premiere, Tyler?
we'll talk about, okay, I think we have to talk about Vulcan Hello and Battle at the Binary Stars together. For us, it was a premiere event over the course of one evening in which we watched this, and I think both of us came away with the same reaction. We liked what we saw.
Yeah.
We don't know exactly what we saw. We have no idea what this series is going to be week to week.
Yeah.
And I'm totally down for the idea that this is a new era of, you know, television. You got to, you know, subvert expectations. But then do I fall back onto that old school thinking like, well, for a premiere, you should be establishing your premise and your characters in a very strong way.
Yeah.
I mean, we enjoy these episodes. We think they're strong episodes, but how do you think it is as a premiere? Does it do the job of a premiere from your estimation or however you want to judge it?
Well, you know, I was the one referencing earlier the cast of characters that all get killed basically by the end.
Yeah.
Does it do what? No, I remember when we reviewed this one and I really was at the end like, I don't know what to make of this show. Like, I don't know that this... Of course I was going to keep watching. That was never a question.
Yeah.
But I wasn't excited. I was more like, what the hell was that?
Yeah.
Which I don't think is a great thing for a premiere.
we were stunned.
Because we're in, but yeah.
Yeah, but no, we were stunned when the episode ended because like it was also like a 34-minute episode or something, a Battle of the Binary Stars, and then she's being sentenced for mutiny.
Right.
And she's getting hard labor.
Yeah.
And then the episode just cuts to black and... We're watching this literally on TV because it airs on cable television in Canada. So I keep like fast forwarding and I'm like, nope, those are the credits. That's the end of the episode.
Yeah.
But we just walked away going, huh.
Yeah.
You know, like, so what is the episode or what is the series going to be week to week? We still haven't seen the titular ship yet.
Yeah.
There's a whole bunch of names in the titles that never appeared on screen.
Right.
So... I don't know if this is a great series premiere, even though they're two very strong episodes. Like, we both genuinely like these episodes.
Yeah, and look, we know there was a lot of creative tumult behind the scenes on this one.
There still seems to be, even into season 3.
Yeah. Do you think that this would have been what they would have started with had, you know, Fuller gotten his vision? Like, this sort of,
I think the reason why we have this is 100% Brian Fuller. He's there to subvert expectations for Star Trek. And I think this is totally his idea. Let's make people comfortable with one situation and totally shake things up. Like, that, if you see his other series, that's always what he's doing. And so, I just think the problem with what would happen with the rest of season one, though, is like Brian Fuller, creator of the show as well as a writer on Star Trek Voyager, he wasn't there to realize what his true vision was. And that's why I think there was some, you know, missteps in season one. And it was never meant to be an ongoing series. It was meant to be an anthology series that would essentially be rebooted. So I think he would have done some even more drastic things like going forward. So I don't know. It's a weird sort of situation that we have with Discovery. It's also a very unique situation.
It is. And I know when we did our rankings of the season one Discovery episodes, at least for me, like the two premiere episodes weren't near the top. They were somewhere in the middle.
Mm-hmm.
But it's weird in that, like, when this episode ends, I think the only thing pulling you into episode 3, if you are someone who has no attachment to Star Trek or like us doing a podcast where we are going to be covering it anyway, the only thing carrying you into episode 3 is how much you care about Burnham. And I don't know that it accomplishes its job spectacularly in that regard.
Yeah, and part of the issue, though, this is a very different Burnham, though, because she is much more aloof as well. So you've got kind of this emotionally cut off character who is making some questionable decisions throughout this. And so you're like... I've come around on Burnham, but it's like it's a tough ask for a lot of those audience members, though.
Yeah, and I mean, Saru's there as well, but I don't know that you necessarily are like think like Saru is going to play a huge role in the next episode. It doesn't like end in a way where you're like, oh, I can't wait to see what Saru does next.
Yeah. I'll say this. The other thing is, so in terms of main characters,
yeah,
you're only introduced to Burnham and Saru,
yeah,
in your first two episodes. I mean, you can make the argument that Volk, blah, blah, sure, blah, but Volk is essentially a different, yeah, character than Ash Tyler, even Volk's though it's very the same memorable actor. He's very memorable, but
yeah,
is Volk a main character? I'd say no, it's really confusing with identity, mm-hmm, stuff, blah, 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 but it's really Ash Tyler is a main character.
Right.
We don't meet him until like five episodes in.
Yeah.
So your first two episodes, by then you've only met two main characters, and it's just like, huh, okay. Yeah. It's, look, I'm all for them shaking things up.
Sure.
Believe me. Like, sure. I would rather they take, you know, like wild swings instead of just getting like, you know, these underhanders like the whole time.
Right.
Like, I'm fine with this. I think this is like a an interesting experiment.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I don't know if it's the way you do a series premiere.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is tough because when I do look, and I said, you know, that I ranked these two premieres in the middle of my season one rankings. But then when I really think about it, of any of these episodes that we've talked about in this podcast, how many of these are in your favorite Star Trek episodes?
Of all time.
Yeah.
I wouldn't put any of them in my top 20 of... Actually, maybe Broken Bow would be, okay, in my top 20 of Enterprise episodes.
But very few.
Very, like, few, yes.
Very few of these premieres land in the, you know, top of their series.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of like, I don't know how fair it is to really hold that against Discovery, a new series especially that we've only watched two seasons of. But yeah, like... I did find this to be a frustrating premiere.
The question
time.
Is, are you tuning in next week? Is the viewer tuning in next week?
I think what probably works for it is this newer model of TV where you have the serialization, where it's like something's happening next. And you can't say that this premiere isn't propulsive. A lot happens.
Yeah.
And so you would have the sense a lot's going to happen in the next episode. It's just a matter of... I don't know that they had the right hook of, like, people really caring about Burnham going to prison for her life.
But, you know, that might not necessarily matter in this era of, like, binge, sure, mode TV, because I think how most people are going to be watching it is after all the episodes are already out there.
Yeah.
And so you watch, you know, the first two episodes, which... It's not even a series premiere event anymore when
new viewer's just watching the Vulcan Hello. That's the premiere.
Yeah.
In which case, I think it's a pretty bad premiere.
is it? Like, premiere?
I mean, not a lot happens. In terms of being the first episode to grab people, I don't know that it's necessarily like, oh my God, I can't wait to see what happens next.
I mean, it ends with the act of mutiny, though.
True.
You know, which is not something that we see on Star Trek. I don't think it's a bad premiere.
Maybe bad's a harsh word, but it's not a home run.
No, but you know, if you're watching it in the new era of binge TV,
yeah,
it's how these are constructed now.
Yeah.
So I think it's totally... Like, if you're going to, like the way TV was made 50 years ago, maybe you'd be a little, like, stunned by it. But, I mean... I don't know. To me, I don't think it's, by the way that we measure it, like, in contemporary times, I don't think it would qualify as anything, like, objectively bad. It's just different.
Sure. But when I compare it to, say, the premieres of shows like Breaking Bad or Boardwalk Empire, Better Call Saul, they did a far better job, like, grabbing me and convincing me why I want to go to the next episode.
Those weren't designed with binge mode in mind. Like, binge didn't really exist back when those series did premiere, though, and they weren't on streaming services either. And I think this was developed specifically for a streaming service with that storytelling model in mind, where they know most people are just going to have to say, oh, I wonder what happens next. And I think enough happened in the Vulcan Hello that you'd be like, okay, I'll see what happens at Battle of the Binary Stars, because S is going to go down.
Right.
And then you get to the mutiny sentence, and they're like, wait, what is this series? I need to watch episode 3 to figure out what goes down. I think... Maybe we can, like, contemplate it yet again, but I think this is a premiere that works for the way people watch TV now.
Right.
I think we do have to give it some credit for that.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And I think we just then have to question, yes, it's following this model, but is it doing it in a way that's, you know, top drawer?
Top tier, yeah. I know what you're saying there.
Yeah.
So maybe that can be an interesting segue over to Star Trek Picard, because I think we're getting a lot of the same... storytelling devices being used, though. And like we're hearing, like, think of this as like a 10-chaptered film, you mm-hmm. know, or a 10-hour movie, which I really hate it when like TV people say that.
Right.
I'm just like, no, you should be making TV for the sake of TV. It's like different formats, blah, blah, blah. Anyways.
Plus, given how movies are going these days, I don't know that's something you really want to champion.
Yeah. So I think this is going to be an interesting one here. Like, I would expect, don't have super high expectations for a real easy hook, line, and sinker, oh, I figured out the premise of this. I think they want to take their time. Mm-hmm. I think they're slowly going to introduce characters. I think the basic premise will probably be revealed, and I think Picard's got to help save some woman and go on a mission. Yeah. I think that's kind of the basics that we'll get by the end of episode one.
I would hope so. Do you think, you know, we talked about how the Berman era, they kind of learned their lesson premiere to premiere. Do you think they would have taken or will take any lessons from how they introduced Discovery? I mean, it's tough to say without watching it.
Yeah,
but
it's also tough to say because of maybe the creative people, you know, behind it.
Yeah.
You know, as well. Look, I don't think episode two is going to end with the execution of Picard. And then we have to wonder what the series is going to be week to week.
Right.
You know, I just think what it's going to do is they are kind of chopping the overall story into 10 pieces. And, you know, they don't want to be beholden to some of that more classical storytelling structures. And I think that's just something that we're going to have to adjust to. For this, I think what we need to be focused on is, okay, so we'll get the introduction of Patrick Stewart as Picard.
Yeah.
I don't think this is going to be the same dominant character that we're so familiar with from another era. I think we have to be ready for a different kind of Picard.
Well, we kind of have to reestablish who even this character is in that premiere.
Yes. And then we're also going to have to get used to some of the new actors that he'll be playing against week to week. And so we'll have to see, well, what kind of chemistry does he have with them? Are they intriguing, layered characters? We'll have to dig into the story, whether this is a story that we're really invested in. The truth of the matter is, Ken, we're watching all 10 episodes no matter what.
Of course.
It's just how excited are we going to be based on the premiere. I'm saying, people, don't get your hopes up. Like, just temper your expectations. Be prepared. It's the binge era of TV. Mm-hmm. This is not meant to be watched week to week like Trek was, you know, way back in the day.
Right.
This is, most people are going to be binge watching it like, you know, 10 episodes in a row over the course of a weekend, you know, when the library is all said and done.
Do you think they're going to start with a 2-episode premiere? Do you think they'll stick to the 1 hour?
I'm guessing they'll stick to 1 hour.
Because there's only 10 episodes.
Because there's only 10 episodes.
Yeah.
You know? So, and I, do you think that they'll premiere, have they already said if CBS is going to have like the network television debut like Discovery got?
They have not mentioned anything because that was pretty well promoted when they said Discovery would air that way. And I have not heard anything like that for Picard.
They got a lot of viewers as well.
I don't know why they wouldn't do it for Picard.
I think they'd be very smart to do that. I think they'd get even more viewers than Star Trek Discovery did.
Yeah.
You'd get a lot of easy promo for that for CBS All Access. Like, I just think it totally makes sense for them to do that.
This feels like the lone one of these Star Trek shows they're doing where they actually could have just put this to network TV. Like, I think they could have sustained it for 10 episodes with Patrick Stewart.
That doesn't come into the equation anymore, though.
But it does feel like the only one that could have worked there, like could have drawn the audience that I think they kind of want on network TV.
I know what you're saying, but like, that's not a consideration for them whatsoever. Like they understand that the entire future of their business model relies on them building these content libraries, and it's just the CBS creative model, though, as well. It's very episodic shows. It's those crime procedurals. It's, you know, that sort of stuff. It's mm-hmm. it's not geared towards like this heavily serialized high concept television. So that's, I just don't think it worked within the CBS model either way.
Right.
But, like, I totally know what you're saying. And, like, it could have sustained itself, but for how long? Do you get three seasons out of that? Like, probably not.
Maybe it is like The X-Files, where you get that first season that everyone goes nuts over, and then ratings just drop after the novelty wears off of seeing Patrick Stewart on TV again. Who knows, right? Because you need so many viewers when it's on television.
It's just, you'd be giving people less impetus to get onto CBS All Access, which is what CBS is trying to get you to do.
So. Now, when Discovery premiered and they aired it on CBS television, That was like a 2-hour premiere on in television air,
no,
right?
No, it or was it? It was 1 hour on CBS, and then the subsequent
hour
available. Battle of the Binary Stars was available that night on CBS All Access, I thought was very genius on their part.
That is very
smart.
Well.
Yeah.
So. Okay. Well, I mean, I guess with Picard, then that would be interesting if they would air that premiere episode and then be like, come back in a week for the next episode.
Come back to CBS in a week or
to
CBS All Access?
Yeah, in a week versus like it's available tonight.
Yeah, I think what their plan, if I was going to guess, is they would have 1 hour on CBS, the broadcast network, and then the episode 2 would not be available until the next week on CBS All Access.
Right.
That's my guess.
So you don't have that immediacy of jump over now and watch the next episode. It's like come back in a week and see it online.
I just think it's there's only 10 episodes, and they want to stretch out how long people will be subscribing to CBS All Access. So, Cam, we're going to have so many more series premieres to indulge in the coming months and years, I suppose. So maybe we'll have to revisit this. But why don't we get to our rankings, though?
Okay.
Like, I did mine before you came here to our Subspace Studios. And
sure.
So I totally reserve the right to change them up I see fit, as we've discussed all of these. But
I found them very difficult to rank when I got to the upper levels, just because, like, as I said, none of these are my favorite Star Trek episodes.
Yeah.
So it's kind of like, well, that one did that a little bit better, but I never had one where I was like, home run, I love it.
Yes, I'm totally with you. And I'm also thankful that I did rewatch them just because they're in my brain now. And I feel I can be more objective as opposed to just relying on like some faint memories from the last time I watched them. But why don't you take it away? Do your 1 through 6 here.
Okay, so I put it number 1, Caretaker, which, the reasons I said I just felt like established the show the best of any of them in terms of a show I would want to keep coming back for.
Right.
Number 2, I had Broken Bow. A lot of the same reasons. Number 3, Emissary. Number 4, The Man Trap. Number 5, The Vulcan Hello / Battle at the Binary Stars. And at number 6, Encounter at Farpoint.
If you had to hypothetically add the TAS series premiere in there, where would you put those in the rankings? What episodes between?
I would put it smack dab probably in the middle. I'd put it a spot above Man Trap and right under Emissary.
Okay. Cool. For me, number 1, Broken Bow. I just think it's a swashbuckling adventure, establishes a premise quite strongly.
Mm-hmm.
Number 2, Emissary. I just think this is a great way to establish your characters and the premise of the series as well. After that, I'm surprised. It's actually Caretaker number 3. For the longest time, I thought it was the strongest premiere, and then I just watched them all within like a week's time, and I was just like, you know what? Too many slow spots here, too many kind of rough patches, and that kind of surprised me.
And rough platforms.
Rough platforms, sorry. Number 4, Vulcan Hello, Battle of the Binary Stars. Number 5, I give it to The Man Trap. You know, it's like, it's kind of plucked out of the middle of the season. It still works, you know, but not perhaps a top 20 episode, though.
Right.
And finally, at the bottom of my list, Encounter at Farpoint. It's just, it's a weird one, even though it starts off strong.
Yeah.
And then you get to Farpoint, and it drags.
Yeah. There was one I wanted to just ask you about. You don't have to put it in a numbered list, but I was thinking of The Cage, which is such a fantastic episode.
Yeah, yeah.
Would you put in that, like, near the top, in the middle, or near the bottom?
At the top.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you.
It's a very strong, in terms of a high concept episode. Character-wise, though, I'm not sure I'm tuning in for the characters week to week after this, though. Like, Pike is not the Pike that we love so much as portrayed by Anson Mount or Bruce Greenwood.
Yeah.
It's not a strong lead character. It's somebody who's uncertain about what he even wants from life at this point.
Does it establish any character well of its cast that would be going forward?
I don't know. Like, I'm looking at Spock giggling at flowers.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean, all of them, like Boyce, the Yeoman, they all feel very minor. It's the female lead.
Oh, number 1 is kind of the cool one there. Sure. Oh, and then, yeah, you're talking about Vina.
Vina. Like,
yeah.
Vina's the big dynamic character in the pilot.
Yeah.
Which is questionable from a, you know, selling a series approach.
Okay, well, Cam, let's have some more fun. What if we had to throw the Carbamite Maneuver in there? Because that was meant to be the series premiere.
That might be my number 1.
Really? Okay.
I think that might be my number 1. Yeah.
Okay. I would put that top 3. for me.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it would bump Broken Bow. I could see it bumping Caretaker.
Right.
I would put it, yeah, probably three.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now here's another one, Where No Man Has Gone Before.
I would put that above Encounter at Farpoint. This is a weird one. I'm just like... Yeah,
I actually think it's a terrible pilot.
Yeah. Like, yeah. You can understand why they didn't go with this.
Well, Mud's Women was the other one that was up for the pilot.
Oh, God.
So. But, like, yeah, it's so weird because it's a Gary, like, Gary 7 story. Or not
or Gary
7,
Mitchell.
Gary Mitchell. There's so many Garys. Yeah. But, yeah, it was like a Gary Mitchell story. It's like, how is this a good pilot?
I don't know.
Good episode. You know, okay episode, but not a good pilot.
Okay.
Okay, so until Picard enters the arena and we can rank him, I think our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to the Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next time?
We're already back to our Enterprise two-part episode review, so tune in for Shockwave. Cam, I've got some gazelle speeches ready to go, so don't you all worry. It's going to be a fun one.
I think this might be the one I'm the most excited to revisit of the Enterprise two-parters.
Yeah.
Because it's one that, like, it doesn't stick out hugely in my memory, but I know there's some really interesting stuff in it.
Yeah.
Like, other ones, there's ones you're like, that's great. That's not great. This one, I'm like, it might be great. I don't know.
It's all about Daniels.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam. V is in voracious appetite for salt. Smith.
You can find me at Reportin. That's Reporton. N as in networks be interfering with series premieres.
Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.